After all these years, I've still got to drop the mic. It's how I know I'm back at Dixon. But it's really such a blessing to be here, to see. It's always wonderful to see familiar faces. It's even more exciting to see unfamiliar faces. So we're just so blessed to be back with you. Thank you so much, Matt, for having us and for taking the time to pray for Ariel and to, just accept our request on that as well. Like I said, Fiona and I were really happy and blessed members of this church family for a long time. We still certainly feel like that. This is the church. I remember where I was just thinking as we were singing earlier, I remember when this carpet was being laid down and we had like a big working beam. We had to pull up the nails from the old floorboards. I remember when we went through 700 working papers and 15 committees to decide our vision and our mission statements. I'm so excited that we're getting to renovating the bathrooms. I saw this amazing flat screen TV out there, so that's a big blessing too. But that and the bathrooms, and I think we're there. But I used to think, I mean, this is the church where God introduced me to my wife. He taught me how to preach. He taught me about small groups. There are people here from the small groups that we were in that we used to pray with. He taught us so much here. And when we left Canberra, I used to think that Dixon was the greatest little church in Canberra. But I've been corrected now because we've travelled around a lot and I've preached in about 15 countries in the last few years. So now I know it's the greatest little church in the world. So please rest assured. And that's the end of the message. Thanks for having us. Let me just pray to begin. Heavenly Father, we just commit this time to you. I just pray that that I would increase, that you would decrease, that all of us here would have open hearts and minds, and you would speak truth to all of us and meet us where we are this morning with your truth. In Jesus' name, amen. The other thing I was just reflecting on this morning when I was getting ready is the last time I was wearing this jacket was when I was working up at Parliament House. And it was a few years ago. Now, as Matt says, I think about 4 years ago, almost 5 years ago now. And so I worked up there for about 7 years as a political advisor, and I did some speech writing and some policy work, and I was part of all of the chaos up there when, you know, we started changing prime ministers every few minutes. And even now when I preach around the world, particularly in Asia, where they're kind of in touch with Australia and they know what we're doing down here, the easiest opening joke, if I can't think of anything else, is I say, I'm from Australia, we have a special political system there. Every time Apple releases an iPhone, we change the Prime Minister. And they love it. Well, it seems like you guys are changing the system now after the last election. But I worked up there for 7 years, and most of my working life, I practiced law for a few years, but all I really remember from working life was in politics. And we were young, we were like in our early and mid-20s, me and some friends, we were just blessed with these jobs that we didn't really deserve, we were way underqualified for. And so we were writing speeches and sitting at cabinet tables and working with prime ministers and ministers. And around this time, we all got addicted, basically, me and my group of friends up there, to The West Wing. And many of you will know what this is. It's a political drama that's set in a fictional White House. And the writer of The West Wing, who I think still is the best living writer of television screenplay, Aaron Sorkin, he invented this president using about 15 other US presidents from true history. And he mashed different aspects of them together to invent this president, President Josiah Bartlett. And that was the president that The West Wing depicted, 7 seasons of it. And if there's only 2 things you take away from this morning, it's the thing I say at the end of the message and to go and watch The West Wing. If you haven't seen it. And one thing that he got from President John F. Kennedy was a little plaque that sat on JFK's and Josiah Bartlett's desk in the Oval Office. And the plaque said, "The sea is so big and my boat is so small. The sea is so big and my boat is so small." And I found that just quite a powerful thing. I know it wasn't out of the Bible or anything like that, but certainly working up in politics with the volatility I saw up there, but also just even looking at that sitting on a president's desk, I think that's quite an honest and a true statement for someone who arguably has the most powerful position in the world to still concede that even sitting in the presidency of the United States, the sea that they have to navigate through is so big and their boat is still so small. And it's true of everyone that's ever lived in every age, I think. We've been told these days, again, by the economists and the anthropologists, that we're living in a VUCA world, V-U-C-A, volatile, uncertain, complex, and ambiguous. And so they tell us we're living in a VUCA world. And we often think that, oh, this is the most volatile and uncertain and complex and ambiguous that it's ever been. But you look through history and it's always VUCA. It doesn't matter where you've lived. And in fact, the term VUCA was coined in the late 1980s, right, by the management and leadership theorists then. So it's true that it is a VUCA world. The question is, what kind of volatility are we dealing with and how can we navigate it? But it's undeniable that whether, no matter what you believe, but particularly as Christians, the world that we're in right now, out through those doors, is volatile, it is uncertain, it's complex and it's ambiguous, and the sea seems really big and our boats seem really, really small sometimes. And in the midst of all of that, trying to find truth and trying to share truth in this post-truth world can seem really daunting, right? And we are called as Christians to share this love of Jesus, to actually tell other people about him, whereas a lot of the time we're not even certain ourselves, we're struggling with the questions that we might have ourselves. So wherever you are on this journey, wherever you are in your walk with God, in your search for God, or indeed you might be sitting here in your rejection of God, this is for you. This is from God to you today. He understands that the sea is big and our boats are small. And I just want to address this passage that was read in three different kind of subtopics. The first is relational truth. The second is authentic conviction. And the third is ultimate fulfillment. Relational truth, authentic conviction, and ultimate fulfillment. Now, I think it's important to start with this concept of truth because I just said that this is a post-truth world. Now, we can't even decide as a society on what post-truth actually means. But I think the best definition I've heard is that this is a world that increasingly is thinking with its feelings. Right? We're thinking more and more with our feelings. We're not really fussed that much out through those doors about what is actually true and what is actually real. It's more about how we feel about that. And in this world, we often hear statements like, well, different people just have their own truths. You have your truth. You might be a Christian. You might believe this. Other people believe other things. That's just for them. This is for you. And we all just need to get along. Well, we all do need to get along. But in the midst of this effort to try and build harmonious and cohesive societies, which is a good thing, we've completely lost the conception of what truth actually is. So I think it's worth, at the front end, actually making some time to think through what truth actually is. Because the first thing that a lot of people deny is that truth even exists. I'm sure there are people in your communities, in your families even, in your workplaces, that will say things like, well, how do we know truth even exists? Truth does not exist. And the whole postmodern project, and certainly the post-truth project, is all about this idea that truth is relative, it's not absolute, it's not real, and we can't know what it is. So the first simple point to make, I know this is a bit sterile at the front end of the message, but is just to make the point and confirm, as controversial as this might seem, that absolute truth does exist. And we know it exists because of this very simple thing. Any attempt to deny that absolute truth exists self-destructs. So if anyone ever says to you, truth doesn't exist, you ask them, was that true? It's all you have to do, and it's game over. I'm actually amazed that the philosophers took 15 years to do away with postmodernism through the 60s and 70s. As soon as you say, was that true, that's a propositional question. They have to answer it with a yes or a no, right? Truth doesn't exist, was that true? If they say yes, they're admitting the truth does exist and undermining their statement. If they say no, they're admitting that their statement's incorrect anyway and undermining their statement. So it doesn't matter which way we look at it. Absolute truth does exist, and we can know what it is. And how do we know what it is? It's very simple. You don't even have to go near the Bible. This is just a principle of logic. Plato said it best, I think. He said, we use reason and we use evidence. It's how we know anything. We use reason and we use evidence. And so when we look here at Jesus' dealings with Philip and then Nathanael, we see this on display. We see it really powerfully on display. And what we see, interestingly, is two categories of truth, right? Because out through those doors, we're told there's only one category of truth, or that there's no categories at all. But there's actually two. There's propositional truth, and there's relational truth. Propositional truth is what we deal with first. The next day, Jesus decided to leave for Galilee. Finding Philip, he said to him, "Follow me." The next thing we see Philip doing in verse 45 is Philip has already found Nathanael and he's telling him about Jesus. So somewhere in there, Philip has already accepted that what Jesus is saying about himself is propositionally true. It's actually true. This Jesus is who he says he is. And I feel like this is a bit annoying by John. This is a bit annoying by the author that he misses this whole thing out. Somewhere between verses 44 and 45, Philip goes through some kind of at least intellectual, emotional, spiritual experience and discerning where he's weighing up who this Jesus is. And all we see is that he kind of comes out the other end and he believes now in this kind of propositional truth, this truth claim that Jesus has made, that he's worthy of being followed. Now, when we look across the Bible and when we look at the whole Christian message and the message of Jesus, there's lots and lots of propositional truth claims that Christianity makes. That Jesus is the Son of God, that the Bible is worth believing, that he actually lived and died and literally rose again. There's lots of these. And it's perfectly healthy for us to question some of these things because they're not normal run-of-the-mill things that tend to happen every day. So if you've got those questions, the Bible is very clear on what you should do. And we see it in verse 46. Come and see. This is what Philip is saying. It's what God is saying to each of us. It's what God's actually saying to those people in your life that you want to introduce to Jesus. Tell them to come and see. Out of all of the worldviews, both theistic and atheistic, there's no other scripture that actually invites people to bring their questions and ask for evidence. And the Bible does it again and again and again. And in my experience as a lawyer, when you have witnesses that have conflicting accounts and one of them is saying, just come and see, just check the CCTV footage, put me on a lie detector test, check the DNA swabs, ask people who were there, it's much more likely that they're telling the truth. So if you've got those questions and if people around you that you want to share this truth with have got questions, we don't need to run away from them. We don't need to be scared of them. The Bible can be trusted. It can be relied on. That's another message. That's another talk. But all of the questions that we could possibly bring to this message of Jesus can be responded to. Because if this gospel is true, and it is, then it can stand up to questioning. You know why? Because truth can stand up to questioning. In fact, truth is the only thing that can stand up to questioning. And we see just a glimpse of the trustworthiness of this message in verse 44, which seems like a really wasted and useless piece of information. It says, Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. Why does that matter? This isn't like a bio or a Tinder entry for Philip. Why do we care about what about Philip? This is about Jesus kind of assembling his team. And yet it says, Jesus decides to leave for Galilee. He finds Philip. He says, follow me. And then it says, Philip found Nathanael and told him, we have found the one Moses wrote about. That's all important. But in the middle, there's this verse 44. Philip, like Andrew and Peter, was from the town of Bethsaida. There are lots of things like this that point to the truth, the literal truth of the Bible. The reason that's important is because what it shows us is that if this is actually a biographical account, an eyewitness account, Bethsaida would need to be on the way from Bethany, where we know Jesus was in chapter 1 of this same gospel, and Cana, which is where we know Jesus is in chapter 2, where he goes on to turn water into wine. And that's exactly where it is. That's exactly where Bethsaida is. It's on the way from Bethany to Cana. And the Bible's chock full of this stuff. You can look at agriculture. You can look at the type of trees and plants that are referred to in the Gospels. You can even look at the type of names that are used in the Gospels. Someone did some research recently on name pattern recognition, which sounds kind of boring. It's actually much more interesting than that. They used all of the non-biblical records we have from Palestine and that area under the Roman Empire of what were the most popular baby names around the time Jesus was born. And they catalogued them, baby boy names, baby girl names around that time. And then they looked at the Gospels of Jesus and looked at what names occurred most regularly in these Gospels. And you find almost a direct correlation to the second decimal point. The exact same. And there's some even more freakishly amazing examples, like Simon, according to this analysis, was by far the most popular baby name at that time. Right, so everyone's called Simon. Mum sticks her head out downtown Jerusalem and yells, Simon, time for dinner. Like 20 kids turn around. Right? So it's like the Michael of my day. When I was in grade 1, I remember there were just Michaels everywhere. We had 4 of them, I think, in our class. So that was Simon. And then what do you see in the Gospels when you look at the Simons? First of all, you see lots of Simons. It's by far the most occurring, that boy name, male name in the Gospels. But you also see that it's never just Simon, is it, in these biographies of Jesus? It's always Simon of Cyrene, Simon the Zealot, Simon the brother of this, Simon from here, Simon from there. There's always a specifier. And I used to always wonder, I don't care about what these guys do in their spare time. Just tell me it's Simon. But then when you look at the research, that's exactly what you'd expect if these were depicting true events. You'd expect that. On the flip side, Philip, according to the research, was one of the least common baby boy names around that time. And what do you see when you see Philip turning up? He's just Philip. Just Philip. No need for a specifier. That's just one example of the evidence that's actually out there that points to the truth of this message, that points to the truth of this Jesus. And if we're willing to come and see, if we're willing to bring our questions, the answers are there. But here's the thing. That's not the end of the story when it comes to truth, because propositional truth is superseded by something even more powerful, and that's relational truth. And so Jesus is not just saying, come and believe in these things and these things and these things. He's saying, come into relationship with me. He says, come and follow me. He doesn't say, come and believe in this. He says, follow me. And so once again, we see the uniqueness of the message of Jesus. As those of you here who are Christian will know, it's actually not primarily about a bunch of stuff to believe in or a bunch of rules to follow. It's about who you know. It's about being in relationship with Jesus. And relational truth is even more powerful than propositional truth. Because I could tell you all kinds of things if I hadn't met you before about my wife, about Fiona. I could point to my wedding ring, I could show you photos, I could show you a driver's license, a passport. But until she actually stepped onto the stage and I introduced you to her, you would have no fully deductive reason to believe that she even existed. I could technically be making it all up. It might point to her existence. But if you stepped into a friendship with her, then you'd know for sure that she was real. It's the same with Jesus. There's tons and tons of propositional evidence. So those of you here who have questions and who need that evidence, please, the Bible is saying, come and see, look for it, ask questions, ask your leaders, ask your pastor, read books, ask for resources. But it's also saying, Jesus is very clear, what I'm looking for from you, is not just belief in me, it's actually relationship with me. So this relational truth is unique to the Christian message. And that's why all of the evidence, and some of it that I've been talking about, you don't need any of that. It's why the four-year-old little girl that got on her knees last night somewhere in Canberra and gave her life to Jesus is in a legitimate relationship with him. She didn't need the propositional stuff. But what we are seeing in a post-truth world is that more and more people are asking questions. People are asking questions. Christians are asking questions. Non-Christians are asking questions. And so it helps for us to be equipped and to know that these truth claims and that this message is actually true. People often ask me, what's the best reason to be a Christian? And I say, because it's true. That's the first best reason. There's lots of other great reasons after that, but they all hang off that one thing, that it's actually literally true. That's the best reason. So relational truth. That's the first thing that we see. Secondly, authentic conviction. Now, conviction's a funny word because a lot of people think conviction is like an opinion or a strongly held belief. I think a strongly held belief is probably more accurate because opinions can change over time. My boss, Ravi, summarizes this well. He says, an opinion is something that you hold, but a conviction is something that holds you. Right? An opinion is something that you hold, but a conviction is something that actually holds you. So let's have a look at what authentic conviction actually looks like. We see it in Philip straight away in this passage. Philip finds Nathanael and he makes no bones about it. He says, we found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph. He's very clear on this. Jesus asked him to follow him. He said yes. He has authentic conviction. He's given himself over to this. He's bought in not just to the propositional truth, but into the relational reality of following and walking with Jesus. Now, this authentic conviction that he's got is pretty important if we're going to be, first of all, finding truth, but also sharing truth with other people. There's nothing more ridiculous than a half-hearted, lukewarm Christian trying to share the message of Jesus with other people. right? Authentic conviction, like that submission, giving ourselves to Jesus and being authentic and convinced in our own heart and our own mind about the truth of this message and about who Jesus is and about what God has done in our lives, is kind of important. It's kind of compulsory if we're then going to take that and share it with other people. One thing that the world hasn't lost is its capacity to sniff out inauthenticity. Right? Doesn't matter what we believe. There's a lot of people out there that believe different things. And if we don't believe it with all of our hearts and all of our minds, then the world out there will work that out very, very quickly. And in 1 Peter 3:15, which is actually the verse on which our ministry was founded and which all good Christian apologetics kind of grows out of, it says, "First set apart Christ as Lord in your heart, and then always be ready to give an answer or a reason for the hope that you have." The first prerequisite is to set him apart as Lord in your heart. It's actually to step into that relationship, to submit to him in everything, to surrender. And those words are ugly words out there today. Submission, surrender, authority. Those are ugly words, but that is the challenge that we're given. We are called first to set him aside as Lord, to authentically submit, to build that conviction for ourselves. And that's why it goes back to this idea of questions. I don't want to keep getting back to this too much, but if we have questions or obstacles that are standing in the way of that, if we have things that seem to be in the way between us and Jesus, then we should deal with those. We shouldn't suppress them. There's nothing worse than someone who's a bit older, supposed to be a bit wiser, getting asked a question by a younger person and saying something ridiculous and unbiblical like, "We don't ask those sorts of questions. We just have faith." If anyone ever says that to you, they're being unbiblical. There's nowhere in the Bible to support that. We just have faith. We just believe. There's nothing blind about Christian belief. It's entirely rational. It's entirely evidence-based. It's entirely reasonable. It doesn't mean we have complete information. There is a step of faith, but it's not a leap. It's not a leap. And so it's really important that we are upfront about our questions. And we see Nathaniel's got it. Nazareth, can anything good come from there? He's asking a legitimate question, right? And the temptation for us, for those of us here who are Christians, is to kind of jump down his throat and be like, "How dare you say that about Jesus? What would you know? Anything good come out of Nazareth? This is God himself as a person, and you're saying, can anything good come out of Nazareth?" He's just asking a question. And people out there and people in here, I'm sure, have similar questions. Why all this suffering? Why trust the Bible? Why bother with God if I'm happy? Why Jesus amongst other gods? All of these sorts of questions. Why does God care whom people sleep with? These are all really good questions. And if the gospel of Jesus, if the message is true, it should have good answers to these good questions. And it does. And it does. So authentic conviction. Thirdly and finally, ultimate fulfillment. And this is kind of the kicker. We talk about wanting to find this truth of Jesus and share this truth. And I've been kind of clinical and technical a bit up until this point. But it really lifts off at the end when Jesus starts speaking, which is always where these passages lift off, right? Because otherwise it's just confused people like us trying to work out what's going on, right? So we see a number of interesting pillars to sharing truth, right? And Philip's really helpful here. He might be the only bloke called Philip in Palestine, but he's very helpful. The first is in verse 45. Philip found Nathanael and told him. Philip found Nathanael. First big pillar. There are people in our lives that we know we want to share this message with. We would love to see them fall in love with Jesus. We've got to find them. We've got to go to them first. Philip didn't wait until Nathanael walked past. Philip went and found Nathanael. So I encourage you, who are the people in your life that you should be praying for? You've got to identify them by name. There's no point being abstract like some kind of social analyst and be like, "Oh, there are so many people in my life and in my family and in my work that need to know Jesus." God wants to know, who's the one person? Who are the two people that you're going to single out and pray for by name every week? The people that you're actually going to go to and make an effort for. Philip found Nathanael. Sharing this truth is about naming the people and authentically investing in relationships with them. We'll talk more about that at these workshops that we're going to do tonight. But Philip found Nathanael. I think that's kind of key. Verse 46 is interesting, right? So Philip says to Nathanael, he's found Nathanael, and then he says, "We found the one Moses wrote about in the law and about whom the prophets have also wrote." So Philip is saying, we found the guy we've been looking for. We found what we've been looking for. Then Nathanael in 46, he says, Nazareth, can anything good come from there? He doesn't reject the premise of Philip's point. He doesn't say, I'm not looking for anything. He accepts implicitly in his response. He doesn't think it's coming out of Nazareth. So he doesn't think that Philip's actually found it. But he says, you can't find that there. Which means Nathanael is looking for the same thing. He's looking for something too. This is a really important truth for all of us. Everyone out there, including everyone in here, we're all looking for that fulfillment. Blaise Pascal, right, French mathematician and Christian thinker, he said, inside everyone there's a God-shaped hole. Everyone's looking for Jesus. They just sometimes don't know what they're looking for. They're sometimes looking for the right stuff in the wrong place. They're looking for the right stuff in the wrong place. So everyone out there, the people on your mind, and most of you, when I said, who's the one person? Who are the two people? You've now got these one or two people in your heads. These names are now in your mind. And you're thinking through all the obstacles and the difficulties and how awkward these conversations are going to be. And I wish this message would just end so we could just go back to going through the Bible and, you know, looking at each other and hugging each other and being Christian together. This guy's making me uncomfortable. He's getting me to think about people in my family. Those people, they're looking. They're looking as well. They're looking for fulfillment. They're looking for Jesus. They're looking for redemption from guilt. They're looking for an answer to conquer through suffering. They're looking for hope beyond this life and beyond their circumstances. They're all looking just like Nathanael. Now, Nathanael's a helpful subject, if you like, because he pretty quickly agrees that they're looking for something. They might not, the people in our lives might be not so quick to agree, but they need it just like Nathanael does. So everyone out there needs Jesus. That's important to remember. They might not know it. They might hate him. They might hate you for loving him. But they all need it just as much as you and I do. So Philip found Nathanael. We have to go to them. Nathanael needed what Philip had found. We can acknowledge that everyone needs that. In verses 47 to 49, this is hugely powerful. When Jesus saw Nathanael approaching, well, there's another little bit in there. Philip says, come and see. And so Nathanael's going to see. So he's agreeing. So Philip and Nathanael have an established relationship of trust. So when Philip says, come and see, Nathanael's now going. Then Jesus says, here truly is an Israelite in whom there is no deceit. Nathanael asks, how do you know me? There's a lovely little ego pat there, right? So Jesus is like, here's this guy in whom there's no deceit. Nathanael's like, yeah, that's me exactly. How do you know me? If Jesus said, you know, here's the most dishonest, you know, bloke in Bethsaida, Nathanael would have said, you don't know me, who do you think you are? But Jesus throws this huge compliment at him. And then Nathanael says, how do you know me? And then Jesus says, I saw you while you were still under the fig tree before Philip called you. That's another little indication of the power of the propositional truth of the Bible. Fig trees were very specifically located to that part of Palestine. So that's another thing. But clearly now Jesus is telling Nathanael stuff about himself that he could only know if there was something supernatural going on. Because Jesus wasn't there physically at the fig tree. So this is the third point, verses 47 to 49. Jesus diagnoses Nathanael's situation perfectly. And these people in your minds, or it might actually be you, and you're not sure yourself about this Jesus, he has the perfect diagnosis for what they're going through. He knows exactly what they're going through. You won't actually find, and you can look through all the philosophy and you can look through all the chicken soup for the soul and the seven habits of highly effective people and how to win friends and influence people and everything, as Ravi says, from Oprah to Chopra. But you won't find a diagnosis of the human heart better than you'll find it in this book. It is piercing, it is penetrating, and the more you try and read the Bible, if you're doing it with an open heart and an open mind, you will see that the Bible is actually reading you. And this is what happens to Nathanael. Jesus just deconstructs him perfectly on the spot, just in this particular situation, but this is the metaphoric power of what he does for all of us. So it's not just that we all need something, but Jesus actually knows exactly what people need and is willing to meet them where they are. So you might have people in your life that you think, they're just never going to become Christian, Max. These people that I've got in my life, they're just so far from God. God's very clear. If this book is real and it's true and it's trustworthy, and I believe it to be all of those things, then God is very clear that he's not far from anyone. Just one step, just one prayer, just one moment. We've seen amazing things in our ministry. One of my friends and fellow speakers, he was an atheistic activist at the University of Sydney and had a Holy Spirit experience at a pub in Newtown and gave his life to Jesus. Now he's on our team, he's writing books. He's just an amazing evangelist and an apologist. Jesus can diagnose us and meet us exactly where we are. But then we get to verse 51, which is really the exciting part. It's the thing that we arguably should be leading with, which is this ultimate fulfillment. These guys have been looking for something, and they've worked out, both relationally and propositionally, that Jesus is the guy. Jesus has proven himself using the propositional truth claims about the fig tree. He's diagnosed it all correctly. These guys know what Moses wrote, and they see who Jesus is. They've worked it out. And then Jesus says in verse 51, "You ain't seen nothing yet. All of this stuff that you've worked out and found, this way that you've come to me, you haven't seen anything yet." That's what he's saying to each of us here, especially to those of us that know him, but also to those of us that don't. If you think you know what I've got for you, you haven't seen anything yet. Jesus adds, "Very truly I tell you, you will see heaven open and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man." You will see heaven open. Jesus is promising a type of fulfillment that we can't even comprehend in our own strength as people. He's offering something that's not quantitatively different to what the world offers. It's qualitatively different. And this is the kicker. People think what Christians talk about when they talk about joy is just a lot of happiness. And with respect to them, that's fair, because when you try and Google it, or you go to the Oxford or the Webster's dictionaries and you look at what's happiness, they say, oh, it's kind of a component of joy. Then you look at what joy means and they say, oh, it's just a whole lot of happiness. So it's a self-referential definition. The world doesn't distinguish qualitatively. It just thinks joy is a whole lot of happiness. What Jesus is saying is no. The fulfillment and the joy that I'm giving you is not just a lot of happiness. It's qualitatively different, not quantitatively different, which means to get it, you have to come to me. If it was just about happiness, you don't need me, because you just find what's out there that makes you happy and just get tons and tons of that, whatever it is. Sex, fried chicken, peanut butter, video games, education, Twitter followers, Instagram likes, whatever makes you happy, just go and do that. But what Jesus is saying is, you are reducing what I have for you to this pathetic little feeling called happiness that you can actually get from just itching a mosquito bite. You think that's all I've got for you? You think that's all I've got for you? Happiness, this feeling that happens to you that changes as literally as the weather changes, that changes as a TV show changes, that changes when your football team loses and wins. You think that's all I've got? No, I've got something far, far better. Fulfillment through me is ultimate fulfillment. Christian joy is qualitatively different to non-Christian happiness. It's not quantitatively different, it's qualitatively different. So there is a resonance here with what Philip and Nathaniel and each of us and everyone in your life. There's a resonance with what we all need that God has, but there's also this offer of fulfillment above and beyond what the world can actually offer us. C.S. Lewis put it really well. He says, "If happiness was all I was looking for, all I would need would be a few friends and a good bottle of scotch." But God's offering much, much more than that. Greater things. Relational truth, authentic conviction, and ultimate fulfillment through the joy of Jesus. And it all comes through this incredible offer that's given to us through grace. This cross of Jesus, where he brings together perfect mercy and perfect justice and perfect love and uses it to offer us through his sacrifice perfect redemption and perfect joy in this life and the next. You don't find that in any other worldview. You don't find it in any other system of thinking or philosophy or anything like that, because it all comes through what he's done, not through anything that we can do. So once again, it's qualitatively different. It's not in our strength. And we know deep down we can't do this stuff in our own strength. We actually are in need of rescue, and that's what God offers us. That's what Jesus' cross is all about. I told you one lie in this message, and I'm a lawyer and a former political advisor, so that's pretty good, I reckon. I said that the quote on Jed Bartlett and JFK's desk read, "The sea is so big and my boat is so small." It's actually not that quote exactly. The full quote is, "Oh God, your sea is so big and my boat is so small." And it's from a prayer that was written by one of the old Navy generals, one of the admirals, actually, during the Cold War, and he presented it to JFK. "Oh God, your sea is so big, and our boats are so small. The sea is big, and our boats are small, but he's the God of the sea, and he's offering to get into our boat with us." And when I thought on this, I thought, this is a really powerful metaphor, it's a really powerful illustration. God, if only, and I was finishing preparing this message for you guys, I thought, God, if only there was something in the Bible outside of Jesus calming the storm, which is kind of a different message entirely, that would really reflect this powerfully. Wouldn't that be great? And there wasn't. There was nothing I could think of. And then when I opened my Bible this morning to do my unrelated devotion just with God this morning, Psalm 107 came up. This is for you guys. Get a load of this. Wherever you are with God, however many people you want to share this love of Jesus with, if you're looking for him yourself. "Some went out on the sea in ships. They were merchants on the mighty waters. They saw the works of the Lord, his wonderful deeds in the deep. For he spoke and stirred up a tempest that lifted high the waves. They mounted up to the heavens and went down to the depths. In their peril, their courage melted away." Does that sound like you? It sounds like me. "They reeled and staggered like drunkards. They were at their wits' end. Then they cried out to the Lord in their trouble, and he brought them out of their distress. He stilled the storm to a whisper. The waves of the sea were hushed. They were glad when it grew calm, and he guided them to their desired haven. Let them give thanks to the Lord for his unfailing love and his wonderful deeds for mankind. Let them exalt him in the assembly of the people." Thank you. God bless you guys. Thank you.